Welcome to the Medicinal Herbs Podcast. This episode is brought to you by HolisticMatters.com, providing nutrition education powered by Standard Process. To learn more about what whole food nutritional solutions that Standard Process has to offer you as a practitioner, visit StandardProcess.com. In this episode, guest Dr. Marisa Marciano returns to talk with host Dr. Dana Parent to talk about the rich history of botanical medicine. In particular, this conversation is about what we know regarding traditional uses and evidence-based uses of medicinal herbs and the impact of the entire body of knowledge on modern herbal medicine.
Hello, and welcome to the Medicinal Herbs Podcast from Holistic Matters. I'm your host, Dr. Dana Parent, and this month, naturopathic doctor and herbalist Dr. Marisa Marciano is back as our guest to talk with us about the rich history of botanical medicine, particularly what we know about traditional uses and evidence-based uses of medicinal herbs, and what impact the entire body of knowledge has on modern herbal medicine. Welcome back, Marisa.
Thanks, Dana. Very, very happy to be here and talking about this with you today.
Wonderful. Now let's get started. And I'm hoping to talk to you about the traditional use of herbs and really how this influences clinical application of herbs today.
Right. Yes. So it's such an important piece of herbal medicine, I think, for any herbal practitioner to acknowledge and maybe start to incorporate some of those traditional uses and practices in herbal medicine. I think it really depends on almost your teacher, whoever kind of taught you and influenced you with their approaches. And, you know, that can come, as we talked about in that podcast earlier, with different, just who can be a herbalist. There's so many types of herbalists, so many traditions of herbalism, what's being passed down to you, and then what you're going to take and what you're going to use with your patients. But my medical training, and I'm sure yours as well, in naturopathic school, leaned pretty heavily on that sort of mechanistic understanding of herbs. There was like sprinkles, of course, of those traditional uses. And something that always stuck out for me that came up in my training was this idea of the biophilia hypothesis. This is something like herbalist Stephen Harrod Buhner wrote a whole book about. And this was research that was done, you know, by biologists in like the 80s, kind of came out around this time where we started talking about exploring the relationship that humans have with plants and with nature, and animals have with nature, and just all beings on this planet, essentially, that there's this kind of innate emotional affiliation that we have, and the therapeutic potential of that, and children in particular demonstrating this like affiliation with nature. Research started to come out around terms like nature deficit disorder, for example. And I bring all this up because most medical philosophies that used herbs as medicine had innately these peoples had a much deeper connection to nature than we currently have. And using herbs clinically now, I see that actually as an extension of this kind of bigger concept of health and wellness that fostering that deeper connection to nature can facilitate our healing really drastically. And so looking to those traditions, you know, from Ayurveda in India to going kind of more modern times, we look at European traditions, you go to the spa to heal, or, you know, Japanese forest bathing, shirinyoku, like, and even now in Canada, physicians can prescribe time in national parks. You know, it's becoming much more mainstream, which is so wonderful to see. We're understanding that our connection with the plant world is such an important determinant of our mental and physical well-being. So all that to say, yeah, those traditions where humans were naturally connected with the plant world, I think that extends now into like ensuring that connection is there, even as we use medicinal herbs with our patients, that they're connecting with the plants and with nature in a deeper way. That's a really core part, I think, of traditional herbal practice. And as a naturopathic physician, something that we learn is one of our, you know, major principles of naturopathic medicine that we give our oath to, you know, when we graduate, that understanding that we have this, the body's so intelligent in its ability to heal, and as nature, and it's our job to just kind of get out of the way, allow it to work, and foster that healing ability through supporting the body with natural means, whether that be whatever that might be, food or herbs or time in nature. So, that kind of is, I think, a core piece that we might forget sometimes when we just talk about prescribing herbs in bottles and clinic. And then other, big influences that from these past traditions that can get lost sometimes in more clinical thinking herbalist is some of the energetics of plants. And, these different medical, every different medical system really that I can think of, ancient medical system that used herbs, and they all did. Humans have always relied on plants for health and healing all over the world. They all looked at disease as kind of a disturbance of balance, some imbalance within the body of different energies, and then herbs, as well as foods and other lifestyle modifications or acupuncture or yoga or whatever it might be, were also seen to have energetic principles that could either, build or remove whatever the imbalance might be in the body. So we look at things like properties of yin and yang in traditional Chinese medicine, the kind of doshic philosophy in Ayurveda are big ones that you end up sort of matching the herbal picture to the patient picture. And that picture, what's deeply ingrained in that picture, we're not just treating a disease, we're treating a person, and their whole physical, mental, emotional state is all built into that picture as well. And that's really important clinically, I think, for us, that we're not just obviously treating symptoms or, a pathology, we're treating a person, which is really key as well.
And I love that you've mentioned herbal energetics, the hot, warm, the yin yang, the different doshas. Can you describe for our listeners, what are some examples of hot or cold herbs? How do we pick those apart? How do we tease that apart? How do we learn our herbs? And can you give some examples?
Yeah, great question. Yeah, so it can seem super overwhelming, I think, too. It's like there's so much to learn about a plant to begin with, and now you want me to learn about like its energies? Like, come on. But I think it can start really basic with things that make a lot of sense to people, like a herb like cayenne is clearly going to be a warming herb, and that just by using your body's ability to sense that from it, right? So that would be on a scale, and there's huge scales for all the herbs, as like what's really warming or a little bit warming or neutral or cooling or very cooling, there's that big spectrum. But generally, using your body to figure that out is a good first step. And then outside of that, there are some kind of more classic ways to group herbs together. Bitters, for example, are almost always considered quite cooling from more of like a Western or Eurocentric approach, which is interesting because the cooling properties, we actually use them sometimes to build digestive fire. And so in traditional Chinese medicine, that's really important to support digestion, and bitter herbs are used to do that, but they're actually viewed as warming. So it can get really, unfortunately, complicated if you're trying to match up every philosophy's view of energetics. It's not going to match up perfectly all the time. So that's something to keep in mind too. It'd be nice if that was the case, but it wasn't. And even between practitioners, some will kind of have their own opinions about that. But I think that the best thing to go back to is what your body feels. And that's what I will support in my patients too. I tend to view cooling herbs as ones that are really rich in mucilage. So think about aloe on a sunburn, that has that you can just feel it right away in your body. Oh, what will that feel like if I put that on my body? It has that gel-like soothing anti-inflammatory quality. And then there's going to be other herbs that it's a little bit harder to tell. Turmeric, for example, in Ayurveda, it depending on the person's dosha or energetic constitution, turmeric might be too warming for that person or too cooling. So it can sometimes need to be fitted to the individual. So clear as mud, probably there's a lot to think about with plant energetics. But in my practice, I try to bring it back to really like taste and sensation in that patient's body, if you can. And that can be really subtle and it can be really obvious at times. And even if you don't get it perfect, don't stress about it. It's an interesting piece, I think, to add. Some practitioners, it's a core part to think about herbal energetics. Others don't think about it really at all, and they still are going to probably have a benefit in their practice. It would need to be pretty extreme if you saw an aggravation or something like that. Not that that can't happen, but it's pretty unusual, I think, in traditional Western clinical herbal medicine.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I just love the fact that you brought up that all patients are individuals. We have to keep that in mind. And there are certain practitioners that may use herbal energetics in their core prescribing or their core recommending. And some individuals don't use this at all. So, you know, maybe finding the proper balance is really what I'm hearing here. And then when I was in school, I learned about the doctrine of signatures, which I found to be absolutely fascinating. And I would love for you to talk about the doctrine of signatures and what does this mean for herbal medicine?
Yeah, so the doctrine of signatures, that's also one I remember learning about it first year naturopathic school. And yeah, just something kind of clicking in my brain and thinking, wow, because it really exemplifies to me I always kind of wondered, like, how did we figure out what herb to use for what? It makes sense now with our, with research methods, how we can figure out what a herb might do in the body, but without sophisticated research practices, like how did we know? And it really came down to, again, this, what we're talking about at the beginning, the connection that plants had with humans. Like, humans were just way more in tune with nature. They were surrounded by plants and using them more regularly and viewed them in some, societies, plants were more like kind of animistic traditions, like were beings. They were people. They were associated with other more like spiritual beings or animals or whatever it may be. So all that's to say that this doctrine of signatures is something, a tradition carried through traditional herbal practice, where humans, when they look to a plant, it gives them some clue as to what that plant might be used for. And so it could be the plant's appearance. So what the plant looks like, it looks a lot like, a common example is hawthorn for the heart. That's a really traditional, often quoted doctrine of signatures. It's like this big bright red berry has this affinity towards the heart and the cardiovascular system. Humans would have kind of put that together, perhaps, to think that curve might be good for that system. It could also be where the plant grows, its environment. So a plant that likes to grow in really wet, marshy environments might have a stronger diuretic effect or ability to remove fluids from the body. It can be helpful in edema or arthritis. I think of horsetail. When you look at horsetail, it really look kind of like it can kind of look like articulation, like bony articulations, like joints. So we think about like reducing fluid from joint spaces, doctrine of signatures there. Or the appearance of the herb, having really large fleshy leaves, that there are a lot of oxygen exchanges happening through, might indicate a herb that would be useful for the lungs and the respiratory system. So those are just a couple examples. There's many, but it really, I think, speaks to, again, this connection that plants and humans have, where they could potentially get some clues as to what. Obviously, it's not a perfect science, and there's, I'm sure, a lot of trial and error for humans, and taking these herbs and thinking what they might be good for. But I think, yeah, it's a very interesting piece, and it was accurate a lot of the time. It was accurate, or at least kind of guided humans in the direction as to what the plant's use might be for.
Yeah, I love that. You know, I remember learning in school about go-to cola and kind of the brain indications. And if you're really looking at this herb, you can see it might have this, you know, this appearance of kind of looking like a brain. I mean, there's so many things out there. You really have to get to know and herb, you know, you get to know the energetics of it, like you're mentioning. And all of this really is coming to us from that traditional use. So in contrast, you know, we're using a lot more research these days with our herbs. And can you talk a little bit about how, you know, modern medicine has maybe changed this view versus kind of traditional medicine? And we're getting into a lot of, you know, learning about the mechanisms of action. And really, what does this mean for herbalism in general?
Sure. So, yeah, something I think kind of the biggest shift happened at the time when essentially pharmacognosy began. So we started looking to plants as potential forms of pharmaceuticals, and you know, some of the first plants that most people are aware of, or that started to happen, was digitalis is one. Those cardiac glycosides were powerful stimulants towards within the cardiovascular system. Willow is commonly quoted as one of the first ones, you know, where salicylic acid was isolated from willow bark and then turned into acetylsalicylic acid or aspirin. So again, we see that there was this period of time where it was kind of like, you know, the sky's the limit. Let's look at every plant. And there was this idea that there was this one active thing that we could find, ingredient, we'll call it, within the plant that could then create a much more powerful and effective and, we'll say, safe product, or at least predictable product that you could give people. And you know, so willow, this long traditional use as an anti-inflammatory and an analgesic herb that would have been consumed as a tea or as a tincture or consumed just whole in various ways, now became aspirin. And so that offers definitely a glimpse of that plant's effects. But it took us, I would say, a few decades to recognize that that is not without its consequences. There's wonderful things, obviously, that have come from those medications, really important things. And I can't remember the statistic, but it's a shockingly large number of drugs have been derived from plants. And looking at the mechanisms of how they work has helped us understand the mechanism of action of plants for sure. But there's also been a lot of research that has taken those individual constituents, removed them, and then given the rest of the plant and to a person to see what happens. And oftentimes there's still a benefit. So it can't be that single constituent. It's a little piece of the puzzle, but we miss so much of the rest of that what the plant has to offer. And yeah, like I say, and I can kind of go in different directions here, I'm realizing, but you know, there, that kind of reductionistic way of taking all the pieces apart, I remember for myself when I was in maybe second year medical school, I went on like a herb camp retreat. And one of the activities my herbal medicine instructor had us do was to pull a rose apart. So we had to take a rose and remove all of the petals and just dissect it, kind of act like a botanist, take all the little parts down and name them and, you know, all the botanical nomenclature. And then at the end, she says, okay, well, what is missing from this picture? And the main thing that all of us, well, obviously it wasn't a rose anymore, but it had lost its aroma, that like essence, its quality, it's like how you know it's rose. And I don't know, that always kind of stuck with me and is a practice that, when you take all the little pieces apart and look at them, you can gain information, sometimes really valuable, but there's something missing that we need to be acknowledging, I think, too. And I think we limit their full healing potential, a plant's full healing potential, by just looking at the individual parts, which is what obviously a lot of our scientific research has done. So I think finding a middle ground is important, and we've learned so much about how plants work through that research, but we need to be humble and recognize that we still don't know everything, and we probably never will. blending the kind of the mechanistic and the vitalistic pieces together is where I think we get the best clinical results.
And I would love to go back to something you said a little bit earlier, and it's the constituent aspect. So can you speak a little bit more about constituents? And, you know, what exactly is that? What does that mean? And, you know, when we're looking at herbs, you know, what should we be looking for?
Right. So constituents are just the name that we give. It's kind of like a herbal term word for the phytochemical profile that a herbal have. They are often, we call secondary metabolites. So they're chemicals that the plant makes for various reasons, for its own purposes, that we thought for a very long time were just waste products, and then come to realize they're actually often some are really strongly acting medicinal compounds. We think of things like alkaloids, which would include substances like caffeine or morphine coming from plants. You know, just a little bit is really powerful. Or other constituents in plants would be things like flavonoids or tannins. I mentioned mucilage earlier. These are other plant compounds that have more broad acting effects within our body. Often they're helping control inflammation because plants are going through the process of photosynthesis. Obviously, they need to make things to help control oxidative stress. And so they're making lots of flavonoids. Every plant makes flavonoids. And so when we consume flavonoids, we can take in those benefits as well. So those are some examples of constituents. There are hundreds that we've discovered, and science is continuously trying to find new ones to find out, you know, in our minds, it's like, what is the thing that makes the plant work? And we're just digging to find these constituents. It's a fascinating field of study. But like I say, you know, traditionally the herb was used in its whole form, and solvents would be used to extract many plant constituents. You would never isolate morphine as a traditional herbalist. You know, a pharmacist might kind of try to concentrate it perhaps within a formula, but still the full spectrum of the plant's constituents was there. So the importance of the whole plant, and a concept again that we talk about in herbal medicine a lot, is plant synergy, or a popularized way to talk about that now is like the entourage effect. You see talking about in relation to cannabis quite often now, is that, you know, it's so much more than just THC or CBD. Obviously, there's tons of different compounds within the plant working together to provide not just, so I would say, you know, potentially a more beneficial effect. That effect might not be as fast acting as a drug works, but it's also probably going to be safer than some of the unintended adverse effects and toxicity concerns that can come from isolating, you know, compounds like caffeine or morphine, for example, or THC. You know, we want to have this kind of more, the more traditional way to use a herb is the whole plant approach. And I think about like a whole food approach is very similar. You know, we want to eat the whole apple, not just take, you know, the vitamin C out of it or whatever. So that's an important piece, I think, is the constituents. And it's interesting to learn about them, but we don't want to get too caught up in the isolation and extraction of them as herbalists. If you're a pharmacist, go for it. It's fascinating. But as herbalists, we really want that whole plant action.
And Marisa, I've heard about artemisinin. Would that be an example of a constituent?
Exactly. Yes. So artemisinin is a constituent that's found really specifically, actually, in pretty significant quantities within a herb called Artemisia annua. It's sometimes called sweet Annie as well. And it's actually a really great example of one of these herbs that the traditional uses have guided it towards making a pharmaceutical that has had incredibly profound effects for humanity, really. And quite interesting, actually, it was a Chinese woman. She won the Nobel Prize for discovering artemisinin within Sweet Annie. And artemisinin then went on to become a really potent anti-malarial medication that is used all over the world and saved hundreds, thousands of lives, I'm sure, as an anti-malarial treatment. All that to say, though, that artemisinin in its that isolated synthetic form has now started to encounter some, it's been shown to encounter some resistance, the parasitic resistance, which is something we know antibiotic resistance is, you know, so prevalent now too. I think that's one of these we're unfortunately now discovering consequences of just isolating plant constituents and using them on their own without the rest of the plant's constituents there to kind of, as it naturally would be found, to support it or act with it, or the body or the bugs aren't as able to potentially build that resistance when given the whole plant. So artemisinin, an incredibly valuable anti-inflammatory, antimicrobial compound used in cancer therapy quite extensively by as an adjunct by many herbalists as well. But it's one of those examples of a constituent that you want to have a good substantial amount of, but you also want to make sure the rest of the herb's profile is given along with it. And then just another great example of a traditional application. So Artemisia sweet annie in traditional Chinese medicine was often given in fever, delirium, and acute infection. So the discoverers looked at that picture and saw this is what happens in a malaria patient. And then that's what kind of led to its discovery as an anti-malarial.
Yeah. And, you know, I remember learning as well. I mean, some of these herbs that you're talking about, I can think of so many different herbs that, you know, because we utilize the whole plant, some of the negative effects that you might see in the pharmaceutical version are actually protected by using the whole plant. So there's so many different herbs where I can think of where that's just incredibly beneficial. And you're not going to have some of those side effects that you would if it's, you know, that plant or that constituent is turned into a pharmaceutical.
Absolutely. I love that you brought that up, because that's also a very important point of when it comes to talking about plants, like safety, and a lot of safety concerns with plants that get brought up are viewing them as being, you're comparing them to the drug's action. You know, aspirin being another example, we know that taking aspirin long-term can have harmful effects upon the GI tract. And some people will say, well, then you shouldn't take willow bark long-term because it will also have irritating effects on the GI tract. Or you might just wonder because, you know, well, then maybe willow has the irritating effects upon the GI tract, where we know historically that's not the case. Like willow has been, you could take willow for long periods without ever having that risk of concern. So that's a really important point. And I think translates to many other herbs as well.
Yeah. And then what can we learn, you know, from all of this, kind of putting this all together from the traditional use of herbs, that's going to really inform us to practice modern herbal medicine, just really consciously and effectively?
Yeah. So we have so much to learn from the traditional aspect of plants. And I think number one for me is that we hopefully follow in our kind of ancestors' footsteps, just having respect for the plants and the people that have used them, and acknowledging some of the practices of how they use them. A really important one to me is, you know, taking only what we need, becoming more kind of conscious of sustainability practices in herbal medicine. You know, not just consuming herbs, this for that. But yeah, just be conscious, that kind of conscious approach to herbalism. I think of my grandmother and how she just would never waste anything. And she's, you know, as a herbalist, she wouldn't call herself that, but I see her as that, as, you know, somebody who that treating the herbs with respect, I think, and not just, we're just consumers of these plants, and kind of acting, an important thing that was always instilled in me as I became, went into my professional career, was that we, if I'm going to be using these herbs in clinical practice, I have to think of myself as somewhat of a steward to the plant world, and we can't be perfect in this, but, you know, what can I do to support the plants so that they can keep supporting us? And that relationship is something that humans and plants have had for a very long time historically. And so I want to always bring that forward into my modern clinical practice, because it ensures that we'll have plants hopefully for a long time to help us. So growing a little, having a little garden, getting, you know, used to, yeah, just giving back in whatever form that might look like is important. And then, you know, from more of the clinician's point of view, I think using the whole plant is incredibly important. Bringing the person in front of you and the patient into maybe the scientific paper you read is also really important. So how we talked about, yeah, an individual constitution, that kind of energetic approach to other traditional practices. You know, you might not be able to name that person's energetic constitution or the plant's energetic constitution, but you do want to factor the person in front of you into, you know, respecting the patient's whole picture and bringing that in as being equally important to maybe the randomized control trial that you read saying that this herb would be good for that. We also, I think, need to evaluate evidence, be kind of a little more critical when we look at evidence. And I kind of get away from the term evidence-based medicine. I instead like to use the term evidence-informed medicine is more how I practice, because I think evidence-informed medicine allows me to put the patient at the center of care rather than just, you know, elevating the research around a certain herb as being the most important thing in my practice. I'm looking obviously to make the greatest change I can directly in that patient's quality of life. So yeah, I need to factor that in. And then also, you know, balancing that with, I might elevate some forms of research over others. Observational studies and case reports and just talking to other herbalists about things that happened. Those are things I think from an evidence-based standpoint might just be considered less important. And as an herbal practitioner, they are quite important to me in balancing that with again, the randomized control trials and probably lowest at the list is in vitro studies when it comes to herbs, and how that translates to the person sitting in front of me is very difficult to say. I think we just always, when we're looking at the evidence, need to be thinking about how this will translate and realistically, you know, make a change in people's lives. So yeah, that's a lot of maybe kind of disparate thoughts there, but I hope that kind of answers your question.
Yeah, I definitely hear you bringing this all together, you know, and I just want to say, I love the term that you use, you know, evidence-informed care instead of necessarily evidence-based medicine, where you're really highlighting that traditional use, you know, talking to other herbalists, you know, engaging in case studies or just your own experience with herbs, how that can really shift your practice, and you can utilize those in your practice. And how some forms of evidence-based medicine might go to the bottom of your list in terms of how significant you use that research in your clinical practice. So I really appreciate that term. You know, I just want to thank you so much for helping us, you know, to understand herbalism as a whole, the traditional use of a lot of these herbs. And do you have any final thoughts for us today just about herbs, about, you know, the traditional use of herbs? You talked about the deeper connection to nature. I know that's really big in your practice. So any final thoughts you want to leave us with today?
Sure. I think as clinicians, you know, I'm really interested in you know, lots of elements. I think there's so much around herbal medicine and so many different traditions that we can pull from, and each of us is going to practice individually. So as someone who might be listening to this podcast today wondering where to go next, just, you know, maybe sitting with that and following what your life, your experiences, your ancestry has maybe brought forward for you, as a good first step to where you might go first. So don't feel like, you know, or, you know, if you just feel really called to understand more about the use of herbs in traditional Chinese medicine, then do that, you know. Or if you read about some herbalist who just, you know, focuses on you know, herbs from a certain region, or a region that your ancestors were from, somewhere in the United States, for example, like, then do that. Like, following, I think that that's a really important thing to listen to as to where the plants might take you and where to kind of focus your energy, because you can't possibly know it all. And as I say, it doesn't all meet up, but there is, I think you're going to fine tune your own skills as a practitioner by following where those passions lead you and connecting with those plants and making time to connect with those plants in your own life, as well as in your patient's life. And that we can hopefully combine everything we know from our medical training with some of that, and in the middle find something that can really, really serve the plants and our patients.
Dr. Marisa Marciano, thank you so much for your contribution to herbalism, herbal medicine, and thanks for joining us on the Medicinal Herbs Podcast.
It was my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me, Dana. See you guys again soon.
Thank you for listening to the Medicinal Herbs Podcast from Holistic Matters, powered by Standard Process. Visit holisticmatters.com to continue your herbal education. That's holistic with a W.